Respected guests, friends, young people, and brothers and sisters. As announced, our topic this evening is on the signs of the times, particularly to be considered in harmony with our study. Thank you. With our study in Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy 7, 18 and 19, we read, "Thou, that is Israel, shalt not be afraid of them, the people who have taken over Israel's land, but shall well remember what the Lord thy God did unto Pharaoh and unto all Egypt, the great temptations which thine eyes saw, and the signs and the wonders and the mighty hand and the stretched out arm, whereby the Lord thy God brought thee out. So shall the Lord thy God do unto all the people of whom thou art afraid." This evening, we will consider what we see going on in the world relating to Israel, and that Yahweh is continuing to work out his plan of salvation in the earth. In March of this year, under great controversy, and against the wishes of the United States President, Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu accepted an invitation to speak before the U.S. Congress. Netanyahu himself had an election coming up, and many thought that he was coming to bolster his position in Israel. But that is not what he was doing. He told the American Congress, "I come to you on the eve of Purim as Mordecai." I think he said Mordecai. He explained a little about what he meant. He told a little about a Jewish girl named Esther, married to the Persian king Ahasuerus, and her cousin Mordecai, and how the Persians under Haman sought the destruction of all the Jews and had received permission from the king to carry this out. Mordecai came to Esther, who was living safely in the palace, and told her this in Esther 4. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this." Esther was successful, and the Jews had a great victory over their enemies in Persia, and the event is still celebrated by the Jews today as the Feast of Purim. But the message from Prime Minister Netanyahu was clear to the American politicians and people. The U.S. leadership was working on entering into an unwise relationship with another Persian king, now called by his modern name, an Iranian. And this Persian, like Haman before him, sought the total destruction of the Jews. Iran had already referred to Israel as a one-bomb state, meaning that it would only take one nuclear bomb to annihilate Israel. And this nuclear agreement, which the world was about to enter into, led by the United States, would by all accounts allow Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon at least within 10 years. And of course, this has now been agreed to by all the current leadership of the United States. Just this past week, the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Russia, and China all came together to sign this agreement, granting Iran a path to nuclear weapons in just 10 years. And that 10 years, of course, is only if they keep the agreement. And there is very little in the agreement which suggests that they must. And the United Nations, just this past Monday, ratified their agreement 15-0. But Prime Minister Netanyahu's point last March to the U.S. Congress and to the American people was the same as that which Mordecai made to Esther. If you keep silent, then relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Now, while we imagine that that Prime Minister Netanyahu is a poor example of Mordecai, and we imagine that the American Congress to be even a worse example of Esther, still Mr. Netanyahu's point is well taken. Yahweh will find a way to preserve Israel, albeit not in the way imagined by either Israel or America. In the first of these lectures this year, in his talk Monday evening, Brother Rankin brought us through the history of Israel from the Garden of Eden to the destruction of Israel by Babylon in 604 AD. Israel was told many things through the prophets about their punishment for their disobedience to Yahweh's laws, and Brother Rankin pointed out several of the more powerful ones, such as the overturning of the kingdom of Judah, and Yahweh's promise that it would be no more till he come whose right it is, which of course is Jesus. But in making these prophecies about the utter destruction Israel was to face, Yahweh also made them a promise about their future. In Jeremiah 30 and 11 we read, "For I am with thee, saith Yahweh, to save thee. Though I make a full end of all nations whither I have scattered thee, yet will I not make a full end of thee. But I will correct thee in measure and not leave thee altogether unpunished." Israel had been warned in their law that disobedience would bring severe punishment. We read, for instance, in the Mosaic Law the following warnings. In Leviticus 21, starting at verse 14, we read, God telling Israel in their law, But if you will not hearken unto me and will not do all these commandments, and if you despise my statutes, or if your soul abhors my judgments, so that you will not do all my commandments, but that ye break my covenant, I will also do this unto you. I will even appoint over you terror, consumption, and the burning auge, that shall consume the eyes and cause sorrow of hearts, and ye shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. And I will set my face against you, and ye shall be slain before your enemies. They that hate you shall reign over you, and ye shall flee when none pursueth. And if ye will not yet, for all that, hearken unto me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins. This precept from the law is particularly interesting for us because this seemingly random expression concerning seven times, it turns out, had much significance. It was actually a prophecy of how long God would leave Jerusalem trodden down of the Gentiles. Jesus had told them in Luke 21 at verse 24, "And they, that is the Jews, shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive unto all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled." We learn here in a very powerful way that Yahweh is still working out his plan of salvation with the Jews. He told them they would be trodden down of the Gentiles till the times of the Gentiles would be fulfilled. And Yahweh had warned them that for their disobedience they would be punished seven times. And as Brother Rankin pointed out to us Monday night, that punishment began in 604 BC when Babylon first invaded Israel and began to fulfill these prophecies of doom on Israel under King Nebuchadnezzar. Now the term time is very significant in Bible prophecy. It signifies the time it takes for a year to be completed. To the ancients, this was 360 days or 12 months or 30 days each. And it's why our circle today is said to have 360 degrees. This was considered to be a time. Israel, through the law, was said to be punished seven times for their sins. Well, seven times 360 is 2,520. And so we find that the time for the treading down of Jerusalem by the Gentiles was to be 2,520 years. What was it? Well, if we add 2,540 years to 604 BC, we come to 1916. But in archaeology, there is no year zero. In archaeology, we go from 1 BC to 1 AD with no in-between year. And so we have to add an additional year to our calculations anytime we cross this time frame. And that brings us to 1917. Well, what significant event happened to Jerusalem in 1917, which would be right in the middle of World War I? And of course, that is the year Jerusalem was freed from the Turks by the British. The following is from the Battle for Jerusalem. We read there, "As a result of these victories, British Empire forces captured Jerusalem and established a new strategically strong fortified line. This line ran from the well to the north of Jaffa on the maritime plain, across the Judean hills to Bera, north to Jerusalem, and continued eastward to the Mount of Olives. With the capture of the road from Beersheba to Jerusalem via Hebron and Bethlehem, together with the substantial Ottoman territory south of Jerusalem, the city was secured. On 11 December 1917, General Edmund Allenby humbly entered the old city on foot through the Jaffa Gate instead of horses or vehicles to show respect for the holy city. He was the first Christian in many centuries to control Jerusalem, which is a very important site for many faiths. Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, David Lloyd George, probably the man who did the most for the establishment of the nation of Israel, described the capture as a Christmas present for the British people, and the battle was a great morale boost for the British Empire. So December 11th, 1917, exactly seven times, or 2,520 years later, Jerusalem was freed from all vestiges of the nations represented in Nebuchadnezzar's image, from the Babylonian head of gold to the toes making up the partially weak and strong nations. In fact, the magazine calls biblical archaeology, which by the way is no friend to the Bible, spending most of their time trying to use archaeology to disprove the Bible. They say that Nebuchadnezzar's conquering of Jerusalem was in the winter of 604 BC, just as General Allenby's entrance in the city was in December of 1917. So it's notable as to just how exact Yahweh is with his words, and just how much confidence we can have that God is still working out his plan of salvation in the earth. It was also in 1917, under the direction of British Prime Minister David Lloyd George, along with Lord Arthur Balfour, that Britain issued the Balfour Declaration, a declaration intended to establish a homeland for the Jews in Israel. Now, we have heard a popular Christadelphian expositor say that Britain issued the Balfour Declaration for the establishment of Israel, and that the rest is simply history. Well, yes, the rest is history. An ugly, brutal, and very deadly history for Israel. For as Yahweh promised, he would reestablish the Jews on the mountains of Israel, but he would not leave them unpunished. Ezekiel described the formation of Israel to be as if one bone came to another until a mighty nation stood up. We see this in the 37th chapter. "The hand of Yahweh was upon me and carried me out in the spirit of Yahweh and set me down in the midst of the valley which was full of bones and caused me to pass by them round about. And behold, there were very many in the open valley, and lo, they were very dry. And he said unto me, Son of man, can these bones live? And I answered, O Adonai Yahweh, thou knowest. Again he said unto me, Prophesy upon these bones and say unto them, O ye dry bones, hear the word of Yahweh. Thus saith Adonai Yahweh unto these bones, Behold, I will cause breath to enter into you, and ye shall live." Here was God's promise that he would take a nation of dried bones, a nation under Gentile domination for 2,520 years, and he would bring it back to life. And Yahweh told us how he would do it. He would do it bone by bone, till they could stand up a mighty army. Again, from the 37th chapter, we read, "Then said he unto me, Prophesy unto the wind, prophesy, son of man, and say to the wind, Thus saith Adonai Yahweh, Come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe upon these slain that they may live. So I prophesied as he commanded me, and breath came into them, and they lived. And they stood upon their feet, an exceeding great army. Then said he unto me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Behold, they say, our bones are dried, and our hope is lost, and we are cut off for our parts. Therefore prophesy and say unto them, Thus saith Adonai Yahweh, Behold, O my people, I will open your graves and cause you to come up out of your graves and bring you into the land of Israel. We shall see that this is what Yahweh did through much trial and punishment to his people. It began with the first Zionist Congress, which was held in Switzerland in 1897. The principal goal there was to lay out the plans for a homeland for the Jews. The early Zionists were looking for a homeland anywhere, not particularly in Palestine. In 1908, the Zionist Congress was renamed Eretz Israel, or the Land of Israel, though the English translation was for some reason the Palestinian Office. And the emphasis was changed at that time from a homeland in any land, specifically to a homeland in Palestine. Into this goal, the Balfour Declaration matched perfectly. Here was the promised homeland for the Jews. But the promise with the Balfour Declaration, the problem with the Balfour Declaration was that it wasn't the only promise that Britain had made concerning the land of Palestine. Britain's involvement in the Middle East had begun in 1915, in the second year of World War I. England found themselves fighting the Ottoman Turks in the Middle East. And to garner the support of the Arabs that they might fight with Britain against the Turks, in concert with Colonel T.E. Lawrence, the famed Lawrence of Arabia, British General McMahon was instructed to make an agreement known as the McMahon Agreement, promising autonomous rule to the Arabs of all strictly Arab land. And that would be following the defeat of the Turks. This is a copy of the map from the McMahon-Hussein correspondence, showing that the only excluded part of the Middle East was intended to be Lebanon and Turkey. That would be the dark area on that map. Still not convinced that they could defeat the Ottomans, Britain the following year in 1916 entered into another agreement for the division of the Arab lands. This one they kept secret between the British, the French, and the Tsarist Russians, and it was called the Sykes-Picot Agreement. This agreement divided the Middle East up between Britain and France. On this map, the red areas are British, the blue are French, and the yellow, which is Palestine, was intended to be internationally controlled. Obviously, this agreement was in complete contradiction to the McMahon Agreement, which is why it was held in secret. Then again, the following year, in 1917, that significant year of ending of the seven times punishment on Israel, Britain entered into yet a third agreement, promising through the Balfour Declaration to provide a homeland for the Jews in Palestine. And this declaration was public, and it enraged the Arabs, who pointed back to the McMahon Agreement. Britain then claimed that the McMahon Agreement only applied to strictly Arab lands. And since the Turks had permitted 200 Jews to live in Palestine, Palestine itself was excluded. General McMahon resigned in protest, and the documents which came to light in 1960, some of which we just showed you, showed that Palestine had indeed been promised to the Arabs in the McMahon Agreement. T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, wrote vehemently against the Balfour Declaration and worked under Winston Churchill in the Colonial Office, quite successfully, by the way, to nullify the Balfour Declaration. Then something worse happened. 2 years later in 1917, after the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia had deposed the Tsar and the Communists had taken over Russia, they wanted to create as much discord as possible between the European powers and the Jews and the Arabs. And so the Communists published the secret Sykes-Picot Agreement, which showed that neither the Jews through the Balfour Agreement nor the Arabs through the McMahon Agreement would end up with control of the Middle East. The European powers were dividing it up for themselves. And so the following year, 1920, the major European powers met at San Remo in preparation for the League of Nations and essentially ratified the Sykes-Picot Agreement, citing the need to curb Soviet expansion as the reason not to honor any of their previous commitments. In early 1921, the League of Nations came into force, and Sykes-Picot Agreement became international law with the British mandated control of Palestine. As you can imagine, this caused great discord in the region, with both Arabs and Jews both feeling betrayed, and with the Arabs resorting to extreme rioting in 1921. Much of the Arab rioting was aimed directly at the Jews, who suffered terribly under it. As Brother Glendon pointed out in a class earlier this week, the Jews wouldn't move to the Middle East, and this is partly why. They didn't feel protected, and they felt at risk due to the Arab hostilities. Ultimately, the Jews decided that the British would not protect their settlements and cities against the Arab rioters, and they began to arm themselves. They formed their first paramilitary group called Haganah, which is Hebrew for defense. This army functioned only in defensive positions with the permission of the British mandate. But feeling that having only a defensive army was inadequate, the Jews formed an illegal army called Ergun, which means national and was short for the National Military Organization in the Land of Israel. Ergun was the forerunner to the modern Likud party, which is the party which rules Israel today, and has known such leaders as Menachem Begin and Ariel Sharon, and today Bibi Netanyahu. It was a terrorist organization taking violent actions against what they called the British Occupational Force, and it took preemptive action against the Arab gangs. By the end of 1921, the Arab riots had become so violent that the Palestine High Commissioner, Sir Herbert Samuel, himself a Jew, by the way, but a British citizen, commissioned the Hayfield Commission of Inquiry. It concluded that the pro-Zionist position of Britain was the cause of the Arab riots. Winston Churchill, who was the head of the colonial office, and of whom Lawrence of Arabia was working directly under at the time, then commissioned the Churchill White Paper of 1922, which essentially canceled the Balfour Declaration. The paper stated that the government did not wish to see Palestine become Jewish, as England is English, but rather the establishment of a center in which the Jewish people as a whole may take, on grounds of religion and race, an interest and a pride. So this white paper laid the policy which Britain would pursue over the next 30 years, which was a Jewish minority population in an Arab-controlled state controlled by King Abdullah of Transjordan. The paper limited immigration by Jews and land ownership under a commission set up of 12 men, 6 British, 5 Arabs, and 1 Jew. Again, this is why the Jews felt so uncomfortable about moving back to Israel. Arab rioting was fierce against the Jews, and Britain seemed to lack the commitment to protect the Jews and the prospect of a Jewish cultural center in an Arab state was anything but attractive to them. This 1922 Churchill White Paper effectively canceled the Balfour Agreement. That the intent of the Balfour Agreement was to establish a homeland for the Jews was testified to by then former Prime Minister David Lloyd George. Nevertheless, Churchill's white paper, heavily influenced by the famed Lawrence of Arabia, denied the intent of the Balfour Declaration, saying the Balfour Declaration only intended a cultural center for the Jews and a state under the control of the Arabs. Yemeni's Jews, who were a large part of the Jews in Israel in the 1920s, already had experienced Jewish life in a land controlled by Arabs, and they wanted no part of this. So now the Jews had no promise of a homeland. In 1929, again, fierce Arab riots led to another British commission called the Shaw Commission, which concluded that Jewish land ownership was leading to too many landless Arabs, and nothing made the Jews like Golda Meir matter than the statements that the Jews stole the land from the Arabs. In fact, they were purchasing Palestine from the Arabs, who were willing to sell. Then they were turning the wastelands into beautiful farms, and the Arabs wanted their land back. The Arabs' riots led to the Hope Simpson recommendations, which recommended ending all Jewish immigration. And this, as Nazi persecution of Jews in Europe was intensifying. Instead of accepting this recommendation, the British government issued a second white paper, the 1930 Passfield White Paper, which banned all future land purchases by the Jews. So the British Commission now banned the sale of Arab lands to any Jews. As Jewish persecution increased in Europe, and with the rise of National Socialism, the need to move the Jews out of Germany in great number led to the transformation of the organization we previously mentioned called Eretz Israel into the Jewish Agency, a private company that interfaced internationally with the governments of the world. The persecution of the Jews in Europe brought great funding, mostly from American Jews, and this became a force internationally. But it was opposed to the goals of the British government, who was trying to stop illegal immigration of European Jews. And so they came into conflict. And now, unable to satisfy either Jews or Arabs with the situation in Europe and Palestine deteriorating, the British convened the Peel Commission to find yet another solution as World War II drew nigh. The commission recommended a divided Palestine where only Jews lived in one part and Arabs lived in the other. But the Arabs refused this, and Britain, desirous of Arab support for the upcoming war, abandoned the idea. The Woodhead Commission was formed in 1938 with the findings of the Peel Commission, and the idea of partition was formally revoked by the British. And this led to another conference where the Jews argued for more immigration, and the Arabs argued against any Jewish immigration and land ownership. And again, the Jews lost the debate. And the result of this conference was the well-known MacDonald 1939 White Paper. This paper limited Jewish immigration to only 75,000 Jews over the following 5 years, from 1939 to 1944. This was to be 10,000 per year, with an arbitrary 25,000 added as desired. And then there was to be no further Jewish immigration without Arab permission. And this was a very small number of Jews, considering the millions of Jews that wanted out of Europe. Then, according to the MacDonald White Paper, 5 years later, in 1949, Palestine was to become a single Arabs-led state with a Jewish minority population. In other words, no Jewish state, but a minority Jewish population living in an Arab state. And the British adhered to this white paper as law till they abandoned Palestine in 1948. And now, as I've already mentioned, many of the Jews living in Palestine at that time had come from Yemen, where a Jewish minority had been terribly persecuted by the Arabs. And they had been kept in abject poverty and fear the whole time they were there, and the Jews had no desire to repeat that experience. It was against all of this persecution and all of these rules that the Jewish state was eventually formed in 1947. And in spite of all these hardships, in 1948, when the British mandate finally ran out, Israel stood up. And when she did so, she showed herself a mighty nation, defeating all her neighbors, an enemy that outnumbered her 100 to 1. If we think about these odds being outnumbered 100 to 1, they are tremendous. For instance, if the United States had to fight the entire world, they would only be outnumbered 20 to 1. So clearly, it was the hand of God bringing about such a deliverance, bone by bone. Israel has now stood as a nation for 68 years. And Israel is a very remarkable story, one which proves that God is still working out his plan of salvation in the earth. The Jews are the proof in the earth that Yahweh is the only God. God said to Israel through the prophet Isaiah, "Ye are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, and my servant whom I have chosen, that ye may know and believe me and understand that I am he. Before me there was no ale form, neither shall there be after me. I, even I, am Yahweh, and besides me there is no Savior. I have declared, and I have saved, and I have showed when there was no strange God among you. Therefore ye are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, that I am ale. As Israel exists as a nation today, after a terrible punishment of 2,520 years, it proves that Yahweh is working out his plan of salvation in the earth. Today, Israel is under attack from most of the northern Muslims in the Middle East. And just to refresh our memories, the Muslims came to power around 600 AD under Muhammad. This would be during those seven times of punishments on the Jews for their disobedience to Yahweh's laws. Muhammad required the Jews to abandon their religion and support Islam. But Islam taught things that the Jews could never accept. For instance, in the book of Islam, we read the following from a chapter called the House of Imran. It says, Ibrahim, which is Abraham, was not a Jew nor a Christian, but he was an upright man, a Muslim. He was not one of the polytheists. Now, no Jew could ever accept that Abraham, the father of the Jews, was not a Jew. Muhammad had stated in the book of Islam, and Muhammad had stated that in the book of Islam, and so they rebelled. And that brought the following entry into the book of Islam from Muhammad. This is from a chapter called The Dinner Table. It says, O you who believe, do not take the Jews and the Christians for friends. They are friends of each other. And whoever amongst you takes them for a friend, then surely he is one of them. Surely Allah does not guide the unjust people. And again, from the same book, the punishment of those who wage war against Allah and his apostle and strive to make mischief in the land is only this, that they should be murdered or crucified, or their hands and their feet should be cut off on opposite sides, or they should be imprisoned. This shall be as a disgrace for them in this world, and in the hereafter they shall have a grievous chastisement. And continuing in that same chapter, Muhammad wrote, Say, shall I inform you of him who is worse than this in retribution from Allah? Worse is he whom Allah has cursed and brought his wrath upon, and of whom he made apes and swine, and he whom served the shaitan. These are worse in place and more erring from the straight path. Now the shaitan is roughly equivalent to the Christian devil, an ugly creature with human forms and hoofs who tempts people to do evil. Now, if you follow the news, at least on a channel that actually gives you the news, you have probably seen an Islamic imam or holy man say that the Jews are descendants of apes and swines. This is actually a part of the teaching from the Quran. So it's easy to see that life under the Muslim Empire, which continued from its establishment by Muhammad in 600 AD and continued without a break until the Turkish Empire lost its hold over Jerusalem in 1917, was a time when the Jewish nation upon the mountains of Israel was completely unthinkable. But Yahweh's ways are not man's ways. And so the unthinkable happened. As we have already seen in 1917, the British, trying to secure the financial assistance of the Jewish League in fighting the Turks, developed the Balfour Declaration promising a homeland for Israel. And while the path to that homeland was one of torturous war and intrigue, Israel finally achieved a homeland, and the nation of Israel was reborn upon the mountains of Israel, fulfilling the word of the Lord in Jeremiah 30, where he said, Therefore fear thou not, O my servant Jacob, saith the Lord, neither be dismayed, O Israel, for lo, I will save thee from afar, and thy seed, from the land of their captivity. And Jacob shall return and shall be in rest and be quiet, and none shall make him afraid. For I am with thee, saith Yahweh, to save thee. Though I make a full end of all the nations whither I have scattered thee, yet will I not make a full end of thee. But I will correct thee in measure and will not leave thee altogether unpunished. So against all these odds, against the teachings, frankly, of many of the churches, starting with the Catholics, but including all the mainstream Protestant churches, and even some of the non-mainstream groups like the Church of Christ and the Jehovah's Witnesses, Israel was established again as a nation. And when we listen to the news today, There was a question often asked, which may not at first appear to have much to do with our discussion this evening, but actually has everything to do with it. And that question is, why do the world's socialists and the world's Islamists appear to have so much in common? Why do they cooperate so closely together? It doesn't make any sense to most of the folks watching, because they would seem to be at such odds with each other. The socialists demand equal rights for women, while the Islamic Sharia law treats women as chattel or property with no rights at all. The socialists demand equal rights for homosexuals, while Islamic Sharia law sentences them to death, most commonly throwing them off the tall buildings. Socialists do everything they can to destroy, or at least to discourage, a church. Yet the Islamists give ultimate power to their church leaders, who they call Ayatollah, a word which means evidence or proof of God. What can these groups possibly have in common that they are so opposite and yet work so closely together? And the answer is simple. They both need the complete eradication of the Jews to prove the validity of their own religion. And yes, socialism, or its related humanism, is a religion. As we have already seen this evening, Yahweh has claimed that the Jews are his witnesses that he is God, and that he is still working out his plan of salvation in the earth. Well, socialism is essentially the doctrine that man can rule himself and that there is no God. Eliminating the Jews, then, would prove the socialist position. On the other hand, the promises to Abraham and his seed are believed by the Muslims to come through Ishmael and not through Isaac. Eliminating the Jews would prove the Islamic position. So the central goal to prove the validity and the correctness of both groups is identical: the complete annihilation of the Jews, and that is what Israel currently faces. Mr. Netanyahu made these comments to the United States Congress when he spoke last March. He said, "I want to thank you, Democrats and Republicans, for your common support for Israel year after year, decade after decade. I know that no matter on which side of the aisle you sit, you stand with Israel. The remarkable alliance between Israel and the United States has always been above politics. It must always remain above politics. Because America and Israel, we share a common destiny, the destiny of promised lands that cherish freedom and offer hope. Israel is grateful for the support of America, of America's people, and of America's presidents, from Harry Truman to Barack Obama." But now, with the nuclear treaty he tried to oppose last March, now agreed to just last week, Mr. Netanyahu has found out that the relationship, in fact, is not above politics. In fact, he has found out that he is a part of the politics of this nation. And this nuclear agreement is far worse than anything Mr. Netanyahu could have imagined. It actually says that the signers of this treaty, the U.S., Britain, Germany, France, Russia, China, will guarantee the security of Iran's nuclear installations against sabotage. And since the primary nation suspected of sabotage against Iranian nuclear installations is Israel, these nations are taking a stand to defend Iran against Israel. These nations, as the treaty stands, are guaranteeing a nuclear weapon to a state dedicated to the destruction of Israel. But you know, it's really hard for us to sit and try and look into the future and see what Yahweh is doing. For instance, a few years ago, during what the world called the Arab Spring, it appeared to all of us that the Middle East nations were going or heading in a direction against Yahweh's plans. Egypt was turning hostile to Israel. The Sunni Muslims appeared ready to collapse Syria and then Iraq. And these Muslim groups were hostile to Russia, weakening Russia's position in the Middle East. And all the nations of the earth appeared to be sanctioning this trend. All appeared to be going against Yahweh's plan. We came down to high that year. And by the time we got through our week and looked at the news again, the entire chessboard of nations had changed. Egypt had thrown off the Muslim Brotherhood rule. and the Syrian-Iraqi attacks evaporated. The Iranian and Syrian friends of Russia regained preeminence. And so suddenly, in just a few days, all had settled down to their proper roles. So this evening, we won't try and guess how this nuclear agreement that includes Britain and the United States will end. We will only say one way or another, it can't stand. At the time of the end, there must be a group of nations styled in the scriptures, the ships of Tarshish and all their young lions set for the defense of Israel. A group of nations who will say to the king of the north, art thou come to take a spoil when the king of the north advances on Israel? We read in Ezekiel 38, Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish with all the young lions thereof shall say unto thee, art thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou gathered thy company to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to take a great spoil? And this nuclear deal has indeed brought Sheba and Dedan, the southern Arabian countries, along with Egypt, closer to Israel, as they also feel threatened by a nuclear Iran. But as for the Tarshish states, it has, for the time being, placed them on the wrong side of the fight. Whether this deal will be affected by the 10,000 protesters who turned out in New York City to protest this deal last Wednesday night, or the 120 Jewish leaders who met with Secretary John Kerry, who wrote this deal yesterday, we can't say. Will that motivate the U.S. Congress to override Mr. Obama's treaty? They only have 60 days to do that. Or whether the U.S. People will put in place a new president in 18 months, the majority of candidates now saying that they will end this deal on the first day of their office. We can't say. Or will this deal fail through the normal treachery and dishonesty of the nations? Either way, Brother Thomas pointed out from the scriptures, the call has long gone out for Tarshish to protect Israel. And one way or another, that will be their final role. But the confidence Mr. Netanyahu places in the Tarshish powers is misplaced. It is why we say that he made a poor Mordecai. The confidence he had in Tarshish when the Tarshish powers are in his land will cause Israel to consider themselves at peace, but it will be a false peace. It will be a false peace because Israel refuses to be obedient to Yahweh. Yahweh will not save Israel because of the righteousness of the current nation, but because of those promises Brother Rankin spoke to us of last Monday evening. As for Israel itself, we learn of their condition of the latter days from our study this week in Deuteronomy. We read there in Deuteronomy 31 at verse 28, gather unto me all the elders of your tribes and your officers, that I might speak these words in their ears and call heaven and earth to record against them. For I know that after my death ye will utterly corrupt yourselves and turn aside from the way which I have commanded you. And evil will befall you in the latter days, because you will do evil in the sight of Yahweh, to provoke him to anger through the work of your hands. The king of the north will be brought forth by God to punish the nations for the evil they have done up to these latter days. The socialist contingencies that make up the king of the north will not understand their role, but rather they will think that they finally have their chance to exterminate the Jews and prove that man controls his own destiny. They think they will be proving there is no God. Instead, God will be glorified through them. They will say against Israel, as written in Ezekiel 38, thus saith Adonai Yahweh, it shall come to pass that at the same time the thing shall come into thy mind, that is the king of the north, and thou shalt think an evil thought. And thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates, to take a spoil and to take a prey, to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited, and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations, which have gotten cattle and goods, that dwell in the midst of the land. Israel will consider herself at peace, protected by Tarshish. But the northern king, Russia, and her European allies will descend into the land of Israel, and God will remove the Tarshish power by a great east wind, as the psalmist prophesied. In Psalm 48 and 7 we read, "Thou, that is God, breakest the ships of Tarshish with an east wind." So Tarshish will make a poor Esther and cannot provide for Israel's protection, no matter how strong and powerful they imagine themselves to be. Yahweh has promised both the destruction of Tarshish through the east wind, and he has also promised the great punishment of Israel by this northern king. How devastating will this destruction be? This is an interesting question. Former Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin promised that Russia would never conquer Jerusalem. Obviously, he didn't read his Bible. We see from Zechariah, who tells us this result from those armies advancing on Jerusalem. In Zechariah 13 we read, "And it shall come to pass that in all the land, saith Yahweh, two parts therein shall be cut off and die, but a third, only a third of the people, shall be left therein. And I will bring the third part through the fire, and I will refine them as silver is refined, and I will try them as gold is tried. And they shall call on my name, and I will hear them. I will say, it is my people, and they shall say, Yahweh is my Elohim." And again, Zechariah tells us, "Behold, the day of Yahweh cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city." So the world socialists and the Muslim haters of Israel will have the Jews exactly where they want them. The complete extermination of Israel will appear to be within their grasp. But then Yahweh will cause them to lose focus. He will make Egypt an irresistible target to them to get them to take their eyes off Israel. In Isaiah 43 and 3 we read, "For I am Yahweh thine Elohim, the Holy One of Israel, thy Savior. I gave Egypt for thy ransom, Ethiopia and Sheba for thee." Russia, unable to resist the ransom offered to her by God, descends into the Egypt, conquering all the lands as they go. And it is then, when this great victory over Israel seems inevitable, all that is left for the northern hosts is to return to their job of destroying the Jews. But then in Egypt, a new army makes itself known in the fight. Yahweh begins his fight first by descending into Egypt, as we learn in Isaiah 19. "The burden of Egypt, behold, Yahweh rideth upon a swift cloud and shall come into Egypt, and the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence, and the heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it." Christ and the saints are this swift cloud which descends into Egypt, gathering the Jews which have fled there before the terror of the northern forces. And following the path of Moses, who led the children of Israel up out of Egypt some 3,500 years ago, Jesus with the saints make their path up the east side of the Dead Sea to prepare to descend down onto Jerusalem and the northern hordes who await them there. Ultimately, the saints come to that location where Moses has been speaking from in our studies this week in Deuteronomy. The place close to where Moses was to die and Joshua was to take over and lead Israel down onto the plains of Palestine. It was the place where Israel learned the Song of Moses. In the Song of Moses we read, "See now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God with me. I kill and I make alive, I wound and I heal. Neither is there any that can deliver out of my hand. For I lift up my hand to heaven, and I say, I live forever. If I whet my glittering sword, and mine hand take hold on judgment, I will render vengeance to my enemies, and will reward them that hate me. I will make mine arrows drunk with blood, and my sword shall devour flesh, and that with the blood of the slain and of the captives from the beginning of the revenges upon the enemy." Rejoice, O ye nations, with his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants, and will render vengeance to his adversaries, and will be merciful unto his land and to his people. And Moses came and spake all these words of this song in the ears of the people, he and Hoshea, the son of Nun, or Joshua. This was spoken from the very place where Jesus and his saints prepare themselves to descend upon the northern hordes on the mountains of Israel. That way had previously been opened up to them under the sixth vial of Revelations. And we know historically that this has happened. In Revelation 16 and 12 we read, "And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared." The Ottoman Empire was this Euphrates River power, and as a result of World War I, it is all but gone, well dried up out of the area. The kings of the east, or more accurately, the kings from the sun's rising, are Christ and the saints, preparing to carry out that purpose described in Malachi at chapter 4. "For behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, and all that do wickedly, shall be stubble. And the day that cometh shall burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts, that it shall leave them neither root nor branch. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his beams, and ye shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall." The Son of Righteousness, described by Malachi, is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, even Jesus the Christ, who comes with his kings from the sun's rising, that is, with the redeemed saints who have found salvation with him in the resurrection, and are now ready to descend on Jerusalem, fulfilling the type Joshua set before them. When Moses brought Israel out of Egypt, he promised them this in Exodus 19. "Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, how I bare you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people. For all the earth is mine, and ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel." Now that expression, "a kingdom of priests," is better translated as in the Septuagint, "a royal priesthood." It's the way Peter referred to it when he told us in 1 Peter 2 and 9, "But ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that ye should show forth praises to him who hath called you out of darkness unto his marvelous light." Commenting on the royal priesthood, Brother Thomas wrote, "The necessary memorial service of the kingdom urges us on to a brief consideration of its priesthood. This is an order in the state composed of men who shall have become priests after the power of an endless life, having been during the interregnum washed and baptized, sanctified by the anointing spirit, and consecrated by the blood of the covenant. These are priests to God, who, saith the Lord, shall enter into the temple and shall come near to my table to minister unto me and to keep my charge. They are then the priests of Zion, clothed with righteousness and salvation, the meek whom the Lord hath beautified. They are representatively styled the sons of Zadok, and they are kings also as well as priests, and therefore priests after the order of Melchizedek. The priesthood of the kingdom is consequently a royal priesthood, and as it is forever, its officials are immortal and equal to the angels. They are perfect as their Father who is in heaven, having no evil in their flesh or impurity in their character. Such are the priests of the kingdom when the saints shall possess it under the whole heaven." The redeemed are a royal priesthood, as they are both kings and priests after the order of Melchizedek, who was both king of Salem and priest of the Most High God. As we read in Revelations 5, we read, "And they sung a new song, saying, Thou art worthy to take the book and to open the seals thereof. For thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God by thy blood out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation. and has made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. And it is in their royal or kingly aspect in which these kings from the sun's rising, led by the Son of Righteousness, descend upon the mountains of Israel from the very spot Moses sung his wonderful song. If they were coming as their role as priests from the sun rising, they would be coming to teach and to convert the world to righteousness, which ultimately they will do. But at this crisis, with the northern king in the city and set to continue to eradicate the Jews from the earth, the saints come in their civil role as conquering kings and roaring lions to take back the city of Melchizedek and to deliver the Jews who are so suffering there. They come to redeem Jerusalem. Joel says in verse 3, explaining the end result of that battle, "Proclaim ye this among the Gentiles, prepare war, wake up the mighty men, let all the men of war draw near, let them come up, beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears, let the weak say, I am strong. Assemble yourselves and come, all ye heathen, and gather yourselves, and gather yourselves together round about. Thither cause the mighty ones to come down, O Yahweh. Let the heathen be wakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat." It's on the east side of the city. "For there will I sit to judge all the heathen round about. Put ye in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come get you down, for the press is full. The fats overflow, the wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of Yahweh is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon shall be darkened, and the stars shall withdraw their shining, and Yahweh shall roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth shall shake. But Yahweh will be the hope of his people and the strength of the children of Israel." May it be our lot, brothers and sisters, respected friends and guests, to be among the righteous who will hear that prophet greater than Moses sound that trumpet to redeem Israel. May we be among those who go forth to destroy the wickedness on the earth and establish a righteous reign, a reign when God is all in all in the earth, ultimating in righteousness for every man instead of the wickedness and the distortion of law that takes place on a day-by-day basis in the world today. May that be our final end.